And it was a very, you know, lowercase go ACC kind of evening in Wallace Wade. Like, for some reason, they delivered flowers to somebody in the stadium, which I thought was really weird because, like, they weren't in a vase and they weren't in water. And so they'll probably be dead by the time, you know, she gets to her car.
Right. You were saying that you feel like that's like you're broken because that's how you that's where your mind goes when you see flowers be brought to somebody.
But I would be annoyed. Like, I'd be like, what am I going to do with these? I have to bring them to the car. They're going to be dead. Like, what are you doing?
You don't know if they're going to allow reentry.
Right. Exactly. Right. They definitely won't. I'm going to have to stuff them in my clear bag or whatever it is. Yeah. And then, like, literally, it was either the, like, media timeout after that or like, one or two later, there was a marriage proposal on the field, too. And, like, that poor guy that got the flowers delivered, you know, somebody should have warned him. Like, maybe do it another week where there's not a marriage
proposal. Not going to look too good. Yeah.
No.
Right.
And that couple ended up, like, making out in the hedges right by the Duke Tunnel for, like, a hot minute. Welcome to an ACC podcast. I'm Lauren Brownlow, joined this week by yet another member of Banner Society, Alex Kirshner, who I finally got to meet in person along with the members of the Shutdown Fullcast this past Friday when they did a live show in Charlotte. And by the way, first of all, hi, Alex. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm so embarrassed that, like, and I asked you guys after the show, I asked Shutdown guys after the show if this was true, but the first, like, person to almost accost the Shutdown Fullcast was someone defending the honor of the ACC, question mark? I'm not sure.
Absolutely. Not even a specific ACC team, as best I could tell. Maybe Clemson, sort of.
No, there's no way it was Clemson. No.
But it seemed like he was just defending the ACC as an institution.
Yes.
Respect.
But that's, like, so not our people. I think I tweeted later that he was like a Diet Feinbaum caller because, like, that's not our ethos. That's not who the ACC is. We're self-deprecating. We don't do the SEC type thing, largely because we can't, but also it's just not who we are.
Yeah, it would have been an exciting way to go had things gotten physical there.
Way to go.
What a way to explain why it is that we all did not make it out of that performance because oh my God, we went to Charlotte and were being too mean to the ACC. Would have been something.
Yeah, you just made some ACC guy mad. It could have been Clemson, although a Clemson guy behind me, when the guy, like, stood up and was like, who won two of the last three national titles, was like, Clemson. And I was like, fair point.
And that's an achievement for the entire ACC.
Yes, exactly. It was a pretty light weekend in terms of actual ACC games, but the games themselves largely ended up being pretty fun.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the game that Caroline Darney, who I had on Thursday to preview the week, she said she might watch if it's on, which for Caroline, if you know her at all, she will watch any ACC content wherever she can get it, and was even streaming an ACC soccer game during the Shutdown Fullcast. So, like, she is addicted. But even that game, she was like, I don't know about Boston College Louisville, but it ended up being really fun and really entertaining. 80 combined points for those two. Louisville wins at home 41-39. We've got five total quarterbacks, sort of, same time. One was a trick play, I think, for Boston College. But Anthony Brown going out with an injury for Boston College at quarterback. Malik Cunningham going out with an injury for Louisville. So you got to see Evan Conley for a little bit longer than we thought at quarterback. It seemed like a pretty fun game. 664 yards for Louisville, 563 for BC. Not a whole lot to take away, I don't think, except for if that's a potential last place game in the Atlantic, I guess Louisville has the head-to-head.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's a shame that we don't have an ACC draft, and there couldn't have been even higher stakes that game. But it's fun. You don't expect a Boston College Louisville game, you know, a post-Petrino Louisville game at that, to be one where they combine for well over 1,000 yards of offense and 50 first downs between them. But that's exactly what they did. So, hey, I mean, no fun going to be made here. That was impressive. It's a good show.
I'm still not used to this whole thing where, like, Boston College is being carried by its offense. Like, that's still very strange to me. And it's a big part of the reason, I guess, that they're where they are right now, because they don't have much of a defense to speak of. But still, like, and it's a shame Anthony Brown went down because, I mean, look, It's not going to be easy. Nothing will be easy for Boston College this year, but Louisville at least is like more fun to watch. And I don't really know what else to take out of this either. Like you said, it just Javian Hawkins is really good for Louisville. He's been playing really well. AJ Dillon does not deserve this.
No, I think Louisville is notably better and more competent looking than a lot of us, myself included, expected they would be. And that's a credit to Scott Satterfield, who has been good enough to have a job like that for a long time and finally got one. And look at this. They look like a much more professional outfit than they did last year or the year before, or in some ways the year before.
Totally. I actually am so – every time they come out and look like this, I view it as a big middle finger to Bobby Petrino, and that's something that we can all absolutely get behind. So,
unquestionably. And they might get bowl eligible. I mean, Louisville, I think, has – better than a 50% chance at this point. They're 3-2 of getting bowl eligible. And, you know, their schedule is ugly from this point forward. I mean, I think they're going to be head-to-head dogs in pretty much every game they play, except maybe a home game against Syracuse. But at the same time, most of them are winnable. I mean, with the exception of Clemson, this is the ACC, and they're all winnable. And Kentucky doesn't have its quarterback and has its own problems in that game at the end of the year. So I think 6 or 7 wins could happen.
Interesting. Yeah, I would have never even thought that that was on the table for them, because of, like you said, the schedule. But you're right. I mean, at this point, maybe Florida State's gotten it together in the Atlantic, although they've already played Florida State, so that's out the window anyway. But, you know, like everybody else, yeah, I mean, NC State hasn't looked all that great. Syracuse certainly hasn't looked all that great. Really, Wake Forest is the only team that's looked pretty good. And it's all on the table for them. So like I have, by the way, this year is finally like the manifestation of what I have always said about the rest of the ACC that's not Clemson, which is that it's all the coastal. So like when the Atlantic Division teams will complain about like, oh, we can't win our division and it's too hard. Yes, you're right. You can't win it because you got Clemson in it. But y'all are all also the coastal. Like you're just in a different division. It's
They are different. They're definitely different.
It's just a different division in name only, but everybody is the coastal. Like Clemson and the coastal should just be.
It's a mindset.
Yeah.
I mean, Pitt is on the coast of the Monongahela River, if you
That's
will.
That's true.
So Boston College is on the coast of, they got a river in Boston. I always forget what it is, but I know they've got
it's like
one.
The Charles? A lot of rivers. Did I make that up?
Yeah, that might be it. I mean, there's every ACC school's got a river somewhere in its spiritual vicinity.
Yeah.
It could be coasts.
Some sort of body of water. Yeah.
Yeah.
That checks out for me.
Louisville's got that river that separates Louisville and the rest of the state of Ohio from Kentucky. So.
Yes, you're right.
Louisville's in Ohio. That's one of the things that I've decided, I think. And Cincinnati's in Kentucky, and we just alternate them as necessary.
Cincinnati really is in Kentucky, which is not something I realized until at one point, like making the drive to Indianapolis. And I'm like, yeah, this is basically all just one sort of state. Like they're basically Kentucky at this point.
For sure.
North.
I realized it when I went to a Reds game one time.
Uh-huh.
And they were like, right over there. That's Kentucky. I was like, oh, you mean right over there?
Yeah, like literally.
Yep.
North Carolina went to Georgia Tech. That played out about like we all thought. Although, you know, I hadn't watched Georgia Tech that closely all year long, really since the Clemson game. And even knowing what their offense was going to look like, it was still kind of jarring to see how bad and disjointed it looks playing out on the field. It's going to be a rough year. We all knew that with Jeff Collins and company, but like it's not. It just looks as bad as it sounds like it would look. It really does. It looks like a mess.
Yeah, it's very bad. I mean, you knew, like you said, that it was going to take some time to wash out the triple optionness of that program and to start recruiting for a system where you might be able to get some more players who don't want to be in the triple option as much as we love and respect the triple option. But it's maybe even a little bit worse than I thought. I mean, they're very, very bad. And I think it's in play, certainly, that they would go. I mean, 1-11 is possible, and that would mean no more wins. But 2-10 or 1-11, I think you're looking at least a 50% chance that it's that bad, that it's, you know, 1-11 or 2-10. So they've got a lot of work ahead of them, and they're not going to be able to do most of it, I don't think, until next year.
Yeah, it's weird. I said to myself that I thought like the later in the year it got, the more you wouldn't want to play them. And I don't – that may still be true. I don't know, but – because, like, the thing is, their defense is not terrible. It's really not. It's just, it's on the field. all the time.
No, their defense is fine. Yeah, their defense is totally fine. But the offense is just, it's every problem that you would imagine you would have when you go from the triple to a more contemporary spread. And then all of those problems being kind of on the worse end of the spectrum from where they could have been. So it just doesn't look good.
On the Carolina side of things, I mean, they played probably about as poorly as you could for most of the first half and still were up like 14 at the half because they managed to score just before the break. And it was sloppy at times. It really was. And they averaged the same yards per play as Georgia Tech, which I don't really know what to make of that at all, if anything. I mean, some of that I think was late in the game, Georgia Tech just trying to make it interesting and whatever. But yeah, I mean, I don't make too much of that fourth quarter scoring burst from Georgia Tech, but
no.
You know, the fact that Carolina, who is a good team but not an amazing team, could kind of like fart around for an entire half and still lead by double digits is is this, yeah, it's not great. I think if you're Carolina, you don't want to repeat that. But
no, you don't. But I would say that North Carolina did maybe a better job controlling the game than that yards per play stat, which is a good, generally a good number to,
yeah.
If you're going to pick one number to look at a game, I mean, that's the one that you look at to be like, all right, you know, generally, how was the run of play here? North Carolina sustained drives a lot better than Georgia Tech did. I mean, North Carolina was running about 8 plays a drive to about 4 for Georgia Tech. So they did a better job holding the ball for longer. I guess.
Yeah. And your yards per play will be less when you do that, obviously. Yeah.
So, you know, and I think they might have, after some explosive plays, they might have had some short ones thrown in there, because they did, at least on the ground. I mean, I don't think their passing game opened things up much, but they had a couple decent runs. North Carolina, still interesting, still better than we thought, kind of in the same way that Georgia Tech, all of the things that you could have imagined there have been on the rough side of where they could have been. I feel like North Carolina, in bulk, things are, you know, if you'd have devised like how well could they have possibly gone for them this year, they're generally going about like that. And that's a credit to them.
Yeah. It's interesting. I think like I have to give you credit for this, by the way. I really do, because you called it. You said you thought North Carolina at the beginning of the year could make a bowl. I thought you were crazy. I really did. Like when I heard you say that, I was like, wait, there's no way. Like with this schedule, there's just no way.
Well,
and
yeah, the thing is they had good coordinators, which was one of the big reasons that I bought into that. And they had a freshman QB who was last year's recruiting class nationally at QB wasn't very good. But I always thought Sam Howell was one of the better QBs in that class, like maybe a top 5 QB in that class. And that's kind of bearing itself out so far, too. So, yeah, I don't know if I was looking as closely at the schedule as I should have been. So that was kind of a reckless call on my part. But I do think they're going to get bowl eligible. I mean, I think they're going to at least win 6. And I think the number where Ryan Nanny would owe me pork would be if they won 7. And I think that's in play.
I think it kind of is, too. Like you said about Louisville, like basically every game on their schedule is both like winnable and losable, essentially, except for Mercer. Like that gives them what? They have 4 at that point. So they need to have at least 2 or 3 more from a pool of teams that includes like NC State and Duke and, you know, teams that are in-state rivals that, by the way, they have like a bad streak against in-state rivals currently where they have not beaten any in-state FBS team, I think, in their last 7 or 8 tries.
Not great.
So
not
that would, great. Yeah, no, they need to snap that. But assuming they can do that against one of those teams, like then you're just looking for 1 or 2 more. And I don't think it's super unreasonable. No. I mean, they've got Virginia Tech. I mean, none of those teams have looked unbeatable at this point. So
no, we'll I mean, see. I think that we'll know if they could do 7 if they beat Virginia Tech. I believe it's 2 weeks from now. I think they have a bye next week, but Virginia Tech appears to be pretty terrible despite having beaten Miami the other day. And if you can win that game on the road, which I still don't think is easy because I don't think it's ever easy to win in Blacksburg.
No, then it shouldn't be anyway.
Shouldn't be. Though a few teams have made it look that way in the last year. If they could do that, then yeah, I think 7-5'sville is a very possible destination for that team. So good for them. And they're fun, too. I mean, they have some really enjoyable players. De'Ami Brown, who's only a sophomore, is like a really dependable receiver for them who can get downfield and run pretty much every route. He's very explosive. Their running back, Michael Carter, decent. Javonte Williams, who comes in behind him, fun player as well. So I like watching
them. Yeah, Sam Howell's fun too, like you were saying. And it's he's a work in progress, obviously, but he has something about him that kind of sets him apart, I think. Like, just he does not seem to care at all when anything happens, bad or good, which is a good quality to have, I guess.
But, oh, yeah. He also looks kind of like he's like 30 years old. So I think
he could be like any age between like 16. He could play a 16-year-old in a movie. For sure. And we'd go like, that guy's probably pretty old.
For sure. But Jason Street in the pilot of Friday Night Lights.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So they're fun. And Georgia Tech, just God bless you. Speaking of Virginia Tech, like, that was the most Virginia Tech way to take a 28-0 lead I've literally ever seen. I think that after that first quarter, they're up 28-0 and they have like 96 yards. largely because like Miami just, oh boy. Yeah. Interception, fumble.
Mm-hmm.
That will do it. And by the way, I'm very sorry to Jaren Williams, because apparently if I say I like you as a quarterback, I have put a hex on you.
Yeah, I feel bad for him. His offensive line just can't really keep him safe, or couldn't really keep him safe. I don't know if that will be a, you know, past tense thing going forward. I'm not sure also how many times each individual QB got sacked for Miami in that game, but they got sacked 7 times. That's a lot of times to be sacked in your own stadium.
Yeah, and it's not even the most times they've gotten sacked in a game this year.
Jeez, you're right. It's not.
They probably are among the bottom, or if not close to it, in terms of sacks allowed at this point. Carolina had a few sacks against him too. And Virginia Tech, it's not like Virginia Tech was out there sacking people every week. Like, that's not what
they
was happening.
They get sacked a ton. I think they're getting sacked on more than 13% of their dropbacks, which is like a bottom. That's a bottom 5 rate in all of FBS. And so they've got some issues. I would not want to play quarterback for Miami this year. I might want to do it socially, because it would probably be very fun from like a living in Miami and being the quarterback of Miami thing. But I don't think I would want to be quarterback for the Miami Hurricanes or the Dolphins for that matter this year.
Yeah, that's a good point. Nkosi Perry back at quarterback. That's not a thing I don't think I thought I would see this year, considering how well Jaren Williams had played and considering how much drama Nkosi Perry had sort of brought to his time at quarterback there with getting suspended, the social media posts with the money. I know Mark Richt wasn't pleased with him. It didn't seem like Manny Diaz was much more pleased with him, because I think Jaren Williams getting the job was a little bit of a surprise to people.
Yeah.
Not just because Tate Martell had transferred in, but also like, wow, he's going to pass Nkosi Perry and Tate Martell. But yeah, that's exactly what has happened. And Nkosi Perry comes back in, 422 yards, 4 touchdowns, 1 pick. I mean, it's weird. I saw like Cam Underwood from State of the U. He's been tweeting about it. And one thing he said was like, maybe it's actually better, weirdly, if Nkosi doesn't start, because when he does start, he's always played like trash. But when he's come in like off the bench, he's been weirdly good. But that'll probably wear off too over time.
Yeah.
Because
I would expect, and Manny Diaz said this after the game, but it just also would track with what makes sense, that Jaren Williams still is going to be their quarterback. And I think you should still be, if you're a Miami fan, if you're looking for a reason for optimism, you should still take him as that. He was quite bad against Virginia Tech, but in the other 4 games he's played this year, which have been against drastically varying levels of competition, obviously, he's been pretty good. You know, he hung in there against Florida really well in the first game, and he got sacked a ton, but showed out, didn't throw any picks, was really good in that loss they had in North Carolina. Obviously, he was good against Bethune-Cookman. I'm not sure how much you care about that. And the same with Central Michigan. But I think there's still more reason to think he's good than to think he's bad. And so Miami should feel probably bad about a lot of things right now, but I'm not sure that their QB is one of them, as long as the offensive line doesn't get him decapitated at some point this season, which is a risk.
Yeah, it's definitely a big if for sure at this point. I hope that works out for them, because I did like him. I thought he played well, yeah. But that was 4 of 7, 47 yards, 3 picks. I mean, none of his passes hit the ground. So
it's true.
That.
True.
And Miami still can't run the ball against anybody. And Virginia Tech had not been super great against the run either. But that's just where Miami is right now. Like you said, no O-line. And that's kind of the end of the story. On the Virginia Tech side of things, I don't know why Hendon Hooker wasn't starting from day one or why he didn't throw a pass in his entire career until the Duke game. Because like to me, he's the guy to be running Justin Fuente's offense. And I always thought Ryan Willis wasn't the best fit. And he played pretty well. I mean, he 3 touchdowns, no picks, 10 of 20 is not amazing, but it's fine. And mm-hmm. then 76 yards on the ground and a touchdown. I mean, that's what Virginia Tech needs. It really is.
Yeah, it's not his fault. Not his fault. I mean, they've got myriad issues, and giving Miami the short fields that led to touchdown drives of like some truly hilarious like yardage numbers, like an 8-play 48-yard touchdown drive, yes. a 2-play 23-yard touchdown drive, a 4-play 20-yard touchdown drive. I mean, like, you know, Virginia Tech has a lot of problems, and their QB play, I agree with you about Willis and about Hooker too. I don't think their QB play is their biggest issue. The passing numbers as a whole obviously don't look very good, but I think that's because they have like a million other issues.
It's not, but I still think Hooker to me is the better fit to run what Fuente wants to do. And
why do you think so? I think I agree. But
I mean, Ryan Willis has some mobility. So because I know that's what people always go to. But I think Hooker is just more of a dynamic rushing threat than Willis is going to be. I feel like Willis rushes as a last resort, whereas like you can do more design stuff with Hooker. And it's a more dangerous option on the run. I don't think you mind Ryan Willis running to beat you, whereas Hooker, I think you have to account for a little bit more. In that area of things. And if Willis is going to be the better passer, he has to have a higher completion percentage and be more careful with the ball. And that just hasn't happened either. So it's like he's not doing enough to offset the fact that he's not as dangerous a runner as Hooker is to me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, but I get it. If you're Fuente, like you have to go with the safer choice. I don't know how you get this far with your backup quarterback having only attempted like 2 passes as to this point. Like, just, I mean, put him in there in any game, literally, just give him a series, you know? I mean, that's something, by the way, that's something that Louisville did with Conley before Malik Cunningham even got hurt. Like, they put him in there for a series against Boston College just to get him comfortable. I mean, you have to do stuff like that. I feel like in college football nowadays, you have to have your backup at least somewhat prepared to get into a football game at some point in time, and having thrown a pass is ideal. It would be good. So
I just realized that I also flipped who was giving up the short field touchdown drives. I think Virginia Tech was scoring them, not giving them up.
Although to be fair, like, they ended up
But anyway, there in the second half, Virginia Tech had a number of very similar problems of its own, giving up, you know, not drives nearly that short to Miami, but they gave up short fields where they gave up touchdown drives of like 61, 65 yards where they, you know, let Miami kind of flip the field on them. And then they gave up these drives. But not great, not great overall. But I should say that it was Virginia Tech that built the big lead. Based on a bunch of turnovers, and we knew that, but we sometimes have a hard time reading drive
charts. Yeah,
while we're talking about it,
it was like the most. It really was a very ACC weekend of football, especially because like there was 1 second put back on the clock after we thought there wasn't 1 second put back on the clock, and ESPN had literally already gone to Georgia, Tennessee. And we were all sitting there. I was in the Wallace Wade press box, and I'm like, we were all like, wait, what? Because I'm following Twitter, and they're like, we get 1 more second here in Miami. And I'm like, where? They already went to another game. We're not going to get to see this. So, but it didn't matter. It was funny. Somebody in the press box was also said out loud. They were like, who has to feel worse if they lose this game? And I was literally like, yes, because no one should feel good about the way that transpired, really. Justin Fuente has to just feel intense relief. And that's probably about it. Like, there's not much joy to be had there. It sounds stupid to say. I think Miami can take something from the fact that they fought back. That's something that I think had the situations been flipped, Virginia Tech would not have done based on what we've seen this season. So, you know, I think Virginia Tech might have laid down a little bit. We saw it last week, the week before against Duke. Like, that's what happened. And Miami didn't do that, so some credit there, you know, for fighting back. And I like Manny Diaz. I like the way they're playing. But like you said, that O-line just means they're going to have a lot of issues.
And Virginia Tech, I would say right now, by the way, is one of, it's been one of the most interesting teams for me to watch all year because they've got this bowl streak. I forget how many years it is, but it's the longest active bowl streak.
It's the longest, yeah.
And, you know, it's an, obviously it's in significant danger this year. And if they get to 6-6, then they actually, according to the letter of the law, should not be eligible for a bowl because two of those wins presumably are going to be FCS wins because they played both Furman and Rhode
yes,
Island.
Yes, that's right.
That situation, that scenario is very much in play right now because they should beat Rhode Island this upcoming week. And then after that, they are looking at games that they will probably be underdogs in every week except Georgia Tech, who we've talked about having troubles for obvious reasons. So I think that seeing how that chaos scenario works out with Virginia Tech and whether they can get to 7 wins and actually make a bowl the old-fashioned way and not rely on a waiver from the NCAA will be one of the, relatively speaking, most interesting subplots of the ACC for the rest of the year.
Yeah, you're right. I had forgotten about the fact that like they could get an exemption, basically, or whatever. Yeah, like a under 500 team.
Oh yeah, there are no rules. Nothing matters in this world.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about that because I was thinking the same thing as you. Like, yes, they'll get a win over Rhode Island, but that won't count. So they're going to have to figure out a way to get probably 7, but they might not. So they might not have to get 7 at all. So we'll see. Yeah, they'll be interesting to watch. I never know what to do with them because it's like you keep thinking they'll get it together and they just don't. So we'll see. Justin Fuente needs this year to go better for sure. And like I said, I was watching the end of that game in the Wallace Wade press box, which means I got to experience whatever you want to call happened in that Duke Pitt game in person. That was really, it was really something. I have like a bad history with Duke right off the bat, as opposed to like the last few years, basically whenever Duke has been in this position to like, okay, they've won a few games, you know, they look pretty good. Maybe they're ranked or on the cusp of being ranked or whatever it is. And then a Coastal Division team X comes into Wallace Wade and they put on a disappointing performance and get blown out, usually is the case. And that's what I thought we were witnessing yet again with Pittsburgh. And it was on its way to doing that. And then Pittsburgh, you know, I guess did what Pittsburgh does, really, which is be very uncomfortable with a large lead of any kind, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Pitt doesn't want to get too high. You can't have that. But people, I think at some point, are going to have to learn that Pitt's MO is not to just play a great game where things go well the whole time and they, you know, walk out feeling great about their performance and they win. No, that's not how Pitt is going to do it. When Pitt wins a game, it's going to spend much of that game looking just horrible, feeling bad about itself, struggling perhaps with a team that is much worse than it, and or in the case of like a UCF, letting a better team that they were beating get back into the game. But then Pitt is going to fall ass backwards into victory or not. But there's a great chance that they will. And that's what happened to Duke. Those poor suckers at Duke.
See, I was feeling like Duke's MO was going to be more powerful, which, like I said, was just to sort of like have a Coastal Division team come in when they're playing well. And then Duke put up an egg at home because that's kind of what they've been doing. They play better on the road than they do at home, which is super weird, I guess. But
yeah,
it's not like the Wallace Wade atmosphere is super intimidating, I suppose, for the visiting team. So there's that. But sure. And it was a very, you know, lowercase go ACC kind of evening in Wallace Wade. Like for some reason, they delivered flowers to somebody in the stadium, which I thought was really weird because like they weren't in a vase and they weren't in water. And so they'll probably be dead by the time, you know, she gets to her car.
Right. You were saying that you feel like that's like you're broken because that's how you, that's where your mind goes when you see flowers be brought to somebody.
But I would be annoyed. Like, I'd be like, what am I going to do with these? I have to bring them to the car. They're going to be dead. Like, what are you doing?
You don't know if they're going to allow re-entry.
Right. Exactly. Right. They definitely won't. I'm going to have to stuff them in my clear bag or whatever it is. Yeah. And then like literally it was either the like media timeout after that or like one or two later, there was a marriage proposal on the field too. And like that poor guy that got the flowers delivered, you know, somebody should have warned him, like maybe do it another week where
you're
there's not a marriage
proposal. Not going to look too good. Yeah.
No.
Right.
And that couple ended up like making out in the hedges, right by the Duke Tunnel for like a hot minute.
Did we keep eyes on what happened with the flower people afterward?
We did not. No, okay. we did not keep eyes on them, but hopefully they made it safely to a car and into some water. Because that probably costed. Well, maybe somebody won the opportunity to do that. That's possible. Like,
oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I hope they didn't have to pay extra for that. but it had, I mean, this game really did have everything. Like the officiating was, you know, not great. Just all across the board was not very good. And Pitt had 15 penalties for 145 yards. Is that all? I know you say that, but it did feel like more.
It felt like it was a flag every single play.
It really did. And it was like,
and it was a big flag. It wasn't like an ineligible man downfield flag. It was like a targeting / unsportsmanlike conduct / like
personal foul or roughing the passer or whatever. It was always, it was go big or go home for Pitt, really.
And that fits with their ethos. Also, speaking of go big or go home for Pitt, they had, obviously, I assume many of our listeners today probably watched this game, but Pitt capitalized on some short fields. They had a defensive touchdown. At one point, after Pitt had a 16-play, 68-yard drive, that ended in a pick. And then the next drive had an 8-play, 25-yard drive after, I believe, a big punt return. They had their next bunch of drives in that game went for 19 yards, 42 yards, 25 yards, 7, 8, negative 15, negative 1, 13, 17, 10, 9 yards. Their offense absolutely fell off a cliff for the entire second half. And then they finally fall behind, like they complete their collapse, and they go 4 plays, 82 yards, 47 seconds to win the game. Incredible.
And the thing is, like, I don't think Duke – in fact, I know that – I'm pretty sure they weren't. Like, Duke didn't go, like, prevent. That's not what happened.
No, Duke was trying to, like, win the game.
Yeah, they were blitzing, and, you know, they just caught him in some matchups. And that's, by the way, like, for people who say that, like, that's part of why some teams do play prevent defense, because they want to make sure they don't allow the big play. But I think they were right to make that move, because Pitt's offense looked really shook. And, like, there was no way, you know, if you brought pressure, you didn't want him to get comfortable. But it didn't matter, because Pitt is just, you know, they make no sense. It looked like Duke had tied it a little earlier when they went for two, and they initially said it was good, although that was another weird thing. Basically, what happened was the ref, the same ref, by the way, as I found out later, he called it no good because, like, initially his forward progress was stopped and he didn't get in. And then they sort of pushed him in, and that same ref didn't blow his whistle when he had called it no good, and then just decided, you know what, I'm going to call it good. And we literally make it through the entire commercial break and everything. And like Duke's about to kick off thinking they'd tied the game. And all of a sudden the ref comes back on the mic and he's like, we had an inadvertent signal, which means we will have to replay the try.
Right. AKA, we don't want to make a decision here and we are going to have a do-over.
Mitchell Northam up in the press box covers Pitt. He was hanging out, and he actually looked up the meaning of the word inadvertent, not resulting from or achieved through deliberate planning. And as he said, that both summed up the ref signal and the game itself, really.
Yeah. Can every signal an ACC ref ever makes be considered an inadvertent signal by that judgment?
I was wondering, right? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. But I've never seen that before. Honestly, it makes sense. I mean, if you're a Pitt defender and you see the guy signal no good, you know, you're going to stop. No, so it was like the outcome itself was fine. It was just more like the fact that they let it get there, you know. And I think Duke was just as surprised as everybody else of like, wait.
And I want to say that Pitt, by the way, has for the first time, I mean, this is, I think, Pat Narduzzi's fifth year at Pitt. And maybe it's his sixth, but I think it's his fifth. And they hired him for Michigan State, where he was defensive coordinator. And the whole game there was like, we want to have a Pat Narduzzi defense that actually can stop people. And they didn't look great for much of the second half against Duke. But this is an extremely Narduzzi defense.
It is.
It's 15th right now in SP+. The secondary gets gashed for some horrible big plays because they play Pat Narduzzi doesn't really believe in safeties. So he's just going to, you know, play man-to-man with occasional safety help and blitz the hell out of you. And what's Pitt doing? They're giving up some big plays, but they rate tremendously in all the passing efficiency defense stats and in sacks. So Pitt finally has a good defense. I think Pat Narduzzi finally has the, you know, kind of look that he wants on that side of the ball. He finally has the DBs who can make it work for him. And Pitt is, I'm a Pittsburgh guy. I'm a Yinzer myself. I think Pitt's probably going 7-5 and, or, you know, at least 7-5. I think 8-4 is a decent possibility as well. And, that is better than I thought and than a lot of people thought. So good for Pitt.
Yeah, I've been saying that all year too about Pitt. Like, they just look really good defensively. This is finally the Pat Narduzzi defense that he's wanted to have. And I was saying this as well to my Duke people who were freaking out a little bit about Quentin Harris, especially in the first half. I was like, look, against, I think that they're like 24th in yards per play, I want to say Pitt is giving up. They were at least going into that game, and Alabama was right around the same spot. And so That's the thing. When they play defenses like that, they're probably going to struggle. So they may struggle again against, like, say, Virginia. But Against almost anybody else that Duke's going to see, I think you'll probably see the Quentin Harris that's maybe a little bit closer to the one we saw against, like, Middle Tennessee State, against, like, Virginia Tech. It's okay for him to struggle against a defense like Pitt's or a defense like Alabama's, which is not a sentence I can even believe that I'm saying, but I don't know that we have to take a whole lot away from Quentin Harris's performance in this game. Duke was able to scheme around him a lot against other teams and just wasn't able to do that against Pitt. I mean, it's just the way it is. And I didn't see a lot of option, I feel like, until the second half for Duke, but
Duke definitely made changes. I don't even know if it was even at halftime. It might have been in, like, sometime in the third quarter, but they probably talked it over at halftime. They were definitely a little more dynamic in what they were trying to do in the second half and trying to beat Pitt with misdirection. And it worked to a significant degree.
There was a weird chippiness at play, too. Even before the game, they, like, fought, which not to, like, play too much into some of the Duke stereotypes, but that's not a team that you see often get put out of itself mentally at all. You don't see that a lot from Duke. And I think whatever was going on between these two teams, like, Maurice French was getting into it with some guys, and, like, just there was a lot of, like, post-whistle stuff happening. And I don't know if there's a story there or not. Like, I don't know, like, what was going on, because it's not like you think of, like, Pitt and Duke as bitter blood rivals or anything, but that was...
Well, that's just a couple of ACC historic programs going at it.
Yeah. I mean, I was puzzled by it, but it was definitely interesting to watch play out. I think Pitt was in Duke's head a little bit at the beginning of the game, especially. I mean, Duke's defense was making a lot of mistakes that you don't normally see them make. And they were the same types of mistakes that Pitt was making in the second half, really. Like those post-whistle, you know, personal fouls and whatnot, that you just don't see Duke's defense doing as much, or pass interference or whatever it is. And that's sort of what they were doing, and they settled down a little bit in the second half, but it was weird to see them get out of themselves, I guess. I don't know. It's a weird phenomenon. I feel like this team's sort of taken on Pat Narduzzi's personality in that, like, they're a little bit, what's the word I want to use? Angry? Is that accurate?
They have definite angry vibes around them. And, like, Paris Ford was a good example.
Yes.
The other night.
Oh, my God.
He gets thrown out on what I thought was a pretty suspect targeting call, because I thought the Duke receiver dropped his head right into his shoulder as the hit was coming. I generally lean on the side of caution with targeting calls. I think if a few people get thrown out that shouldn't, that's better than a system where you have, you know, unpunished blows to the head all the time. But, I thought the call in Paris Ford was soft, and he was mad. I mean, he was mad enough that he almost got 15 more for Pitt when he was being escorted off the field. And Narduzzi was just as mad, and I thought he was going to get, you know, his own unsportsmanlike. It didn't happen. They were kind of daring the officiating crew to do it, and they didn't do it.
There's been a number of times in Narduzzi's Pitt career that I have thought he is going to get one of those, because he's like...
I've always thought that Narduzzi might be the guy to get two unsportsmanlikes and get run, but it hasn't happened yet. And they put that rule in a few years ago that you could do it. And he's a candidate, as is, like, Will Muschamp.
Yes.
As is Harbaugh. Like, there are a few of these guys who are definite candidates for that, but it hasn't happened yet. We're waiting very excitedly for the day that it does.
Yeah, I think it's going to. I would put my money on Pat if I had to. I really, really would. Yeah, that's that. It was a pretty wild weekend. I don't know that we have to take a whole lot from it from Duke's perspective. Good win for Pitt. They kind of needed it. And now you've sort of got a situation in the Coastal where we all just sort of throw our hands up and go, okay, I guess we don't really understand anything anymore.
Guess not.
Virginia's holding serve so far, but like, and no offense to my Virginia people. I know I've said this before, and I'm not saying this to pick on you. In fact, I hope it's a reverse jinx for y'all's sake. But like, as bad as Virginia Tech has looked, I think we're not going to count on anything in terms of Virginia beating Virginia Tech until we see it happen. So
until well after we see it happen, I'm going to need like 2 hours to go by
right
before I'm like, okay, they're not coming back out for like an untimed down or something.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, like they're on top of the Coastal right now. North Carolina is right there as well at 2-1. It's a big old shoulder shrug, man. Like that's what it is. And frankly, you look at the rest of the Atlantic, maybe outside of like Wake Forest and potentially Florida State, if they get it together. And I think it's kind of the same deal. Like there's just a whole lot of shoulder shrugging going on right now. I don't know who's good. I don't know what they're going to do. Pitt put itself in decent enough position though, I think, by getting that head to head over Duke. And you know, we'll see. I guess maybe they will repeat history and go back to the
maybe. The thing is, Virginia having that head to head on Pitt is going to make it really, really tough for Pitt. But you know what? I mean, like you said, we don't count on Virginia football too far in advance. So we'll see.
But really, only in regards to Virginia Tech. Like, I want to make that clear because Bronco Mendenhall has done some really nice things. They have really done a good job against the North Carolina schools as well, especially the last couple of years. I mean, he flummoxed Daniel Jones for 3 years. Like,
yeah,
but.
And we should note that if I'm not being snarky and I'm just looking at the way their schedule shapes up, they're probably not going to go 11-1 or 10-2, but they absolutely could. If you just look at what's left on that schedule, that's Miami, which is next
week. That's a big one for them. You know, yeah.
I think that the computers will say that Miami is likely to win that game, but I'm really not sure. I think Virginia is clearly a better team. Duke at Louisville, at UNC, Georgia Tech, Liberty, Virginia Tech. The last three of those games are all at home. It'd be pretty surprising if there weren't at least 9 wins on that schedule. And I think 10 is right there.
Yeah.
So they're good. I mean, you know, we'll see again that Virginia Tech, the computers are going to say they're going to win. And, many of us know better than to be sure about that, but, they're very good. And they, you know, this could be their kind of dream season that they've been waiting for.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that they're in the driver's seat right now, but Lord knows in the Coastal, that never really means much of anything. Right. So, all right, well, that's been the recap of this week. Just so everybody knows, I am going to London tomorrow night. So I will not be doing this podcast. Somebody might be doing it. I don't think Caroline Darney has decided. She was thinking about it. So no podcast on Thursday, no podcast the following Tuesday, but I plan on being back Thursday. I'm going to watch my Panthers. Who knows what my Panthers will do in London against the Bucks? I don't know anymore.
Have a great time.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Thank you. I'm excited, but I just wanted to let everybody know that so they're not like, where's your podcast? Alex Kirshner, Banner Society, where can everybody find you?
I tweet, my name is Alex _KIRSHNER. And we do the same at Banner Society. We also have a Reddit page, and various, podcasts, that you can listen to along with this great podcast. Those are the Shutdown Fullcast and Podcast Ain't Played Nobody.
And an enjoyable Slack as well on game days that I.
Yes. Yeah. Please join the game day Slack. It's a lot of fun.
I enjoy it. All right, Alex, thanks so much.